If the unsurpassed, penetrating, perfect Dharma is unborn and unceasing, it itself is not rare at all. It's the opposite of rare. We might even say it's the only thing that's not even slightly rare, because it's the only thing that's ever present. Even some things that are mostly present are a little bit more rare than this unsurpassed, penetrating, perfect Dharma. But for us to meet with it, now that's rare. Even in millions of eons. This is ridiculously ironic. That which is ever present is that which we most rarely meet. How could that be? It's the ultimate trickery of this universe. And it gives us a reason to build zendos. Yes?
All we's get in the way.
All we's
get in the way.
Yeah. Which is exactly what I wanted to talk about today. The I and the we. We is just an extended form of I, really.
Yeah, all the I's we's.
Yeah. Wait, our ancestor Durdaka is talking about the selfless self. So we've probably all heard his teachings of no self in the Buddha Dharma. And it's usually presented as a more accurate understanding than our usual understanding of ourself as a separate individual entity. Me as the owner and possessor of this body and mind. And when we look for that, we can't find any individual entity, graspable entity that's running the show of body and mind. So something like that is the no self. So self is a conceptual misunderstanding. This kind of independent separate self is a conceptual misunderstanding, and no self is a kind of conceptual realignment. And then letting that conceptual realignment percolate into our direct non-conceptual experience, something like that. So it's a cognitive shift. It's a perceptual shift. It's a paradigm shift. Occurring to me that this body is where a lot of the sense of the separate individual self seems to be held, even if it's a cognitive misunderstanding. And so we could talk about this like there's the unborn, unceasing, ever-present, ungraspable light of awareness, illuminating the entire world and also illuminating itself. This morning this question came up of, well, is awareness really aware of itself all the time? And maybe one image for this kind of thing would be like a light, a candle flame, or one of these lights, or a star or a sun. which is illuminating the room around it, but it's also illuminating itself, isn't it? A light or a candle flame. So it's both at the same time. It's illuminating the world and it's illuminating itself. And maybe if we are like these candle flames, we're mostly noticing how we're illuminating the world, but we don't really notice so much how we're illuminating ourself. So this light that we are, one of the things it illuminates is the body, you know? The sense of some physicality, some tactility. The body, as we experience it mostly, is all these tactile sensations, pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. And again, we've been told, and our kind of like perceptual setup is actually wired to perceive that these tactile sensations are like coming from nerve endings in the skin and so on. This is basic biology, science. And yet, if we go deeply into our experience of the body, our direct experience in Zazen, it seems that we're just finding these sensations. And again, if we can be mindful of the body in this way, the Buddha recommends mindfulness of body, really just directly experiencing these physical sensations. And we do this in Sesshin. Following the breath is also directly experiencing a physical sensation in the body, of the body. But now we have this new practice of turning the light around and opening to the awareness of the body. Who is it that's aware of the body? What is this awareness of the body? Without neglecting to pay attention to the body, just letting the body awareness recede a little bit into the background and letting the awareness of awareness rise up in the foreground. And once we get used to that, to some extent, then we can direct the awareness back outward towards the sensations of the body. From this new perspective of awareness, and again, look just like we can do with sounds and sights, look for the meeting place between awareness and the body, the physical sensations. And it seems to me, when exploring this, that just the same way we can't locate the meeting place where awareness touches sound, we can't locate the meeting place where awareness touches the body or meets the body. Again, with our eyes closed, sometimes may help to do this because it cuts down the number of senses that we're paying attention to. So similarly, then we may be able to experience the body as permeated by awareness, the body as pervaded by awareness. No separate body, separate from awareness, but they're completely interpenetrating. The body permeated by awareness, and then I think it is, in a way, a slightly deeper step or a more radical way of putting it to say, then therefore the body is made of awareness. We're not talking about a biological body here, right? We are talking about a experienced body. The body as we're experiencing it just in this moment. These tactile sensations. Can we see them as made of awareness? That's a different kind of body, isn't it? A different experience. A body, and when I practice in this way, I notice that the actual, what we might call the physical body, seems to relax when I'm practicing this way. It seems to, of course there's still a sensation of the body, but it's harder to keep a lot of tension in the body when we're relating to the body as permeated by awareness or made of awareness. It's a different relationship to it now. So that's a nice kind of side effect of this meditation, but we might say the main effect of it, of this meditation, is that the body is no longer some separate, solid, physical thing, separate from the awareness of it. Yes?
So what you're saying, I thought about death, and at death, there's no more awareness, there's no more breath. And I'm wondering,
there's no more
awareness or breath.
Well, we can say, looking at people who've died, that the breath stops. Whether there's awareness or not, I think there's no way we can speculate about.
It's withdrawn at some point.
Well, how do you know?
There's neurological evidence that it's not there anymore. I'm saying this disintegrates. This container is animated, I'm speculating.
Yeah, yeah.
Animated by the force of life. Or, you want to call it prana, or whatever.
Yeah.
Right? There's an animating force.
Uh-huh.
So I'm seeing, is awareness, there's a question, an aspect of, or is it the animating force? And also, Sojin Roshi says that we're being breathed by the universe.
Yeah, that sounds good.
So here,
That's a good question, though. Is awareness the same as the animating force or prana or chi? And I would say, this is just my own speculation, of course, too, right? I would say no. It's something actually more subtle. In a way, prana and chi is almost like it's in between gross physicality and awareness, but some people call it the subtle body. So it's like, I think it's not exactly physical, but it's the life force, jiva, I think in Sanskrit is the term, that I agree that, in my own speculation, that at the so-called death of a physical body, that not only does the breath stop, but the life force, like the jiva, leaves, and the prana disperses, and the chi disperses. But awareness I'm speaking of it as the unborn, unceasing source. That's what I would say. We actually really don't know. We have all kinds of stories from all different spiritual traditions. We'll talk about this, but we will not know until we have that experience. And even then, it might be that. The awareness that remains, if there is such a awareness at such a time, will not be like our usual perception of it, right? It's almost like when awareness no longer, when the light of awareness has no objects to shine on and it's just illuminating itself, we maybe could talk about it like that at death, is that the objects like the breath, and the sense objects and so on, all those are going to cease. But maybe, I'm just speculating myself too, right? Maybe awareness cannot help but illuminate itself beginninglessly and endlessly, not in the form of some entity. Here it's dangerous because we can start thinking about some sort of soul or spirit, but it's beyond all categories, right? And in this case, and even when we're asleep every night, it's very much like death, right? All the senses shut down. The breath, luckily, is still going, but we're not even aware of the breath, right? When we're really deeply asleep, deep sleep. So in that way, we might speak of it like awareness is radiantly alive and aware of itself, but since there's no objects, we can't say anything about it, and we don't even have a memory of it when we wake up.
It's about dreams, though. There's
well, that's different.
Awareness.
That's completely different than
dreaming,
yeah.
Well, so there's some activity, and also I think and we don't have to get too linear, going into too much detail, but there's a survival part instinct you were hearing still.
Yeah, yeah. It's, which is an interesting example that, yeah, even in deep sleep, and I'm distinguishing deep sleep from dreaming, which is a different state of mind. But in deep sleep, that's a very interesting thing, because we can be deeply, deeply asleep, but we set an alarm clock for that purpose, right? So we hear the alarm out of this deep sleep, which could be said to be evidence that there is a subtle awareness aware of itself in deep sleep with no senses happening. But if there's a sound that's loud enough, then the awareness that's inward focused, it moves out and to the sound and hears the alarm and wakes us up. It's totally ordinary. Yeah. Any kind of, like, the senses are generally shut down, but if it's a strong sensation through any of the senses, when we're deeply asleep, it moves into awareness. So that's how it's different from death. But we might say that even in death, we don't know, right? Again, we have all the scientific evidence. If we say that consciousness is a product of the brain, the EEG goes flatline, and that's the end of consciousness. But again, the awareness that I think that the Buddhas and ancestors are speaking of is not even a consciousness that can be measured. It is, but sometimes we might call it like pure presence, illuminating itself. Could there be pure presence that doesn't rely on any sense objects or even a body? Again, the Buddhist tradition does, these kind of like hardcore meditators are into exploring that kind of stuff, like these different states of kind of deeper and deeper absorption where nothing's happening. And it seems to be like, almost like maybe flatline states that, but there's still a kind of awareness there. But death is a big one, yeah. And, the nice thing about death is that even without being like hardcore meditators, we're all gonna go through this most intense, experience and get to check out firsthand. In one way or another, I mean, I can imagine that, and there's Buddhist stories, which are stories, right? But that the intensity of such an experience will be so overwhelming for us that we'll lose track of awareness. But the theory of the unborn, unceasing Buddha nature is, I think, a pretty good one, even though we can't see it or get a hold of it or grasp it. It starts, the more I explore it, the more all the pieces of the puzzle start fitting together very nicely from this story. So it's satisfying, actually, into my conceptual mind. But that's just conception, right? Anyway, I think this issue of the separate self manifesting as the body, the kind of gross body or body that seems to be separate, almost like view of separate self could be that the body contains awareness. And maybe also similar to a kind of biological physics science kind of view is that consciousness is produced by a physical brain. But we often feel, it seems like, the body is really who we are, and then the awareness is somehow inside the body. And I think that's one way that we hold the view of a separate self. And therefore the body will always be separate from other beings. It's this physicality that ends at me and begins at you. And no matter how close we are together, we can never be one. That's, I think, how it is if the body is, stands on its own as a separate entity. And that's somewhat painful. Even, like all the time. It's a feeling of separation. Whereas if the body is pervaded by awareness, even more deeply, the body made of awareness, then there's a sense in which our bodies are actually not separate. Even when I seem over here and you seem over there, it's like, because we are one awareness, we're not separate awarenesses. There is only this one unceasing, unborn, all-pervading, limitless awareness that takes the form of many bodies. But in that way, the bodies aren't really like, we're not really different people. I mean, we call ourselves different people, but we're like one being. Does that make sense? It's a less separate view. So the separate self is kind of hides in the body as this feeling of tension, bodily tension and separation. And the mental belief in a separate self is just the tip of this giant iceberg of separate self that's mostly held in the body. This is not the usual kind of Buddhist view. Buddhist view really emphasizes the mind always, right? And I think the mind is the source. The delusion is a cognitive delusion. But the way that we've become accustomed to through eons of this cognitive delusion is that the sense of separate self is stored in the body. That's the big part of the iceberg. So I mentioned this because also we can hear hear and understand these teachings of no self and actually shift our view. I think probably all of us have done that to some extent by hearing these teachings. I can see there really isn't a separate self, but I still feel if I'm threatened, this body tenses up, or if I'm feeling just, the body's always a little bit tense, just in this sense of separation. So I think that's just the way the false view has kind of percolated into what we call the body. So that the illusory self is the belief that the body contains awareness, or the real physical body is inherently separate from others, and the true self is that awareness contains the body.
We start out as a body within a body at the moment of conception, being then introduced by yet another body. So we're sort of like three in one, and then one in one, and then we enter the world as a baby.
And we could say all of that, the body within the body, is all pervaded by awareness.
Yes.
And then the specific details of how that works in the physical world, that's what science is really good at. We can, to some extent, we can explain how bodies produce other bodies, and that's the workings of cause and effect in the world. But from this point of view of awareness, it's like all of that is kind of this show, kind of made out of this awareness. And it works in particular ways. It's not like a random show that's different all the time. It follows these patterns of cause and effect that have evolved over billions of years. And but what if all of that is like a kind of magical display of the unborn awareness. Yes.
So, perhaps this feeling of separation is because we tend to live in our heads. Like the attention, when we talk about attention, is here a lot for me.
Yeah.
And perhaps, you know, I'm reading this book about the hara. Breath, you know, breathing slowly. And, you know, one of the things they say is as we age, we start breathing, you know, and less in touch with this. And that perhaps there's the development of the hara, or paying attention.
Yes.
Allows, perhaps, you know, for an actual feeling of connectedness with others as opposed to being separate.
Yes.
Something's enlivened and activated, opened, whatever, by that practice of embodying.
Yes.
Those two hanging out.
Yes, thank you for that. And I think it can work both ways, just like the mirror and the reflections made of the mirror are like a kind of interdependent working. The awareness and the body are also in this way. So this way that I've been speaking of is more coming from the awareness aspect, a little different from in the head. This kind of awareness, right, is the all-pervading awareness with no center or edges. But it is more of a cognitive thing. By this investigation, the body starts to relax, right, when we see. But then what you're speaking of, I think, also is a way to come at the same thing, which is coming from the body angle. And this is like by actually physically relaxing the body, just in the basic way that by attending to the body and letting it relax, right, forgetting all about awareness and so on, and breathing in the hara, like you say, letting the breath fill the whole lower body and circulate through the body, relaxing the body and breathing through the body, then that seems to change the relationship to awareness, actually, and the sense of separation and the strong sense of separate self. Exactly so, yeah. Isn't it interesting and wonderful that it's like almost two different approaches, which of course can be combined. It's not like just one or the other. But in a way, they're two coming at the same problem of the separate self through two different directions. Ideally both. And even I would say, what you bring up, I would say before any of these awareness investigations, I think first good to really relax the body and let the breath circulate through the body, almost like a preliminary practice to investigating awareness. If we're all kind of like this and like, okay, where is the unborn awareness? It's like probably not. So, and I often forget to mention that because it's Sashin, so I'm like, well, probably we're naturally getting into this relaxed body, but it's worth mentioning actually again and again, because actually we can hold a lot of tension in the body. Yeah, thank you. So, dear Paka, remember this story that dear Paka says to his teacher, because one who leaves home is a selfless self, is selfless and possesses nothing, and because original mind is unborn and unceasing, this is the eternal way. All Buddhas are also eternal. The mind has no marks or signs or characteristics, and its essence is the same. So it's a nice explanation of reality from Dirtaka. And then Upagupta says, you must be thoroughly awakened and realize it in your own mind, and then Durtaka was greatly awakened. So it's kind of implying this was a great explanation, but like maybe he had some sense, but you don't really completely realize it. In your mind, we must say also in your body, the whole works. So, Keizan Zenji, our Japanese ancestor, commenting on the story, says, "The one who understands in this way, who understands that this is big mind, still must be said to understand intellectually." After all these great explanations. Therefore, even though Durtaka understood in this way, Upagupta pointed out that he had to greatly awaken to this and understand it in his own mind. It's like placing the imperial seal on commercial goods or merchandise. I guess this is something that they did in old China, right? They, or Japan, where maybe like government approved tea or something, they put the imperial seal on it. Nowadays, they put the CCOF seal, you know, California Certification of Organic Farmers, right? It's not just like some farmer just says, yeah, it's organic. It's got the official seal. It has been investigated deeply and proved to be 100% organic. So when you see the royal seal on this merchandise, you know it's not poison. Just like when you see the organic seal, the non-GMO seal. You know it's not poison, it's not the wrong item, or it's not suspicious, and it's not something reserved just for government use. It's for the public. Therefore, it can be used by the people. This kind of seal. This is the way it is when the paths of teacher and disciple coincide. So, we could say that this is like the royal seal given by a teacher when the student has directly seen the royal seal themselves on the merchandise. Right. So, it's could be like a teacher-student thing. I mean, this issue of Dharma transmission is a lot about sealing. Sealing? Sealing, the stamp, the seal. It's nice that in Chinese and Japanese, the character for seal is what's used to translate the Sanskrit word mudra. Mudra does mean seal, yeah. So it's like mudras, like we have hand mudras and body mudra in yoga, right? There's mudras. It's a kind of a body, they're all physical bodily gestures, and they kind of like, they directly express how we are, we might say, a seal, a mudra. What we chanted at noon service, it's when you express the Buddha's seal in the three actions of body, speech, and mind by sitting upright in samadhi, the whole phenomenal world becomes the Buddha's seal, or becomes the Buddha mudra. So there's something of this seal is some sort of like proof that removes doubt. And there's a teacher-student thing involved, but I think this is following this discussion about there's an intellectual understanding, and then there's this seal that we can actually trust that maybe goes beyond the intellect. Even though you grasp it as principle and clarify it as the way, you necessarily get it for the first time when you're greatly awakened. And then there can be this issue of meeting another, as Keizan mentioned in the previous chapter. And so if one has sealed reality, then another can seal that sealer. In Zen, there's one of the ancient ancestors said, if you have a staff, I'll give you a staff. If you don't have a staff, I'll take your staff away. If you're not greatly awakened one time, he's into this one time thing. By the way, great awakening, Gaigo, or great Satori. Dogen uses this character for Satori over and over. But Satori in the Chinese and Japanese dictionary is not really a Buddhist term. It's just a general colloquial term that just means to perceive or to understand. So did you get Satori? It sounds like some sort of like your body's going to start shaking or something. We're talking about greatly understanding or realizing. And if you don't have this great Satori one time, you will vainly become someone who understands intellectually and never penetrates the mind ground. If you still do not escape naive views of Buddha and Dharma, when will you escape being bound by self and others? Basically, duality. Thus, even if you do not miss a single word of all that was taught during the 49 years of the Buddha's life, and do not get one teaching of the three vehicles or five vehicles mixed up. This is that three vehicles are the Shravaka, the Pratyeka Buddha, and the Bodhisattva vehicle. And I think the five is when you add in like humans and devas, maybe. So you basically got all these classical teachings of the Buddha without being mixed up. But without being once awakened, it would be hard to call you a true patrobe monk. Even if you can expound 1,000 sutras and 10,000 treatises, make the Buddhas reveal their true face or their light, make the great earth tremble and make flowers rain down from the sky, you still have the standpoint of a mere lecturer. Lecturer. A lecturer. Just giving lectures about the awesome, unborn, true nature of all things.
The history of the awesome, unborn.
Yeah, the history. And all these ancestors and their stories. Doesn't it sound good? But you're not a true patrobe monk. You must not try to understand this in terms of... This is nice now because Keizan's going to mention all these great Zen teachings that he himself speaks of throughout this book. And he's actually quoting Dogen too. And he's going to say all of them don't quite cut it in these various ways. So you must not try to understand this in terms of the three realms are mind only. So Sangai Yuishin is the name of a Shobogenzo fascicle of Dogen based on the Flower Ornament Sutra. This quote comes from a sutra and then Dogen writes an essay on it. But don't understand it like that. Also, don't understand it that the true marks of all things. This is Shoho Jiso, also the name of a Shobogenzo fascicle. And a line from the Lotus Sutra that Dogen comments on. Also, don't understand it as entire being is Buddha nature. Shitsu Busho is the name of a Shobha Genzo fascicle where Dogen quotes this line from the Parinirvana Sutra. So each of them is one of the great Mahayana sutras, and each of them Dogen takes up from the sutra and comments on it. All these words, right? And intellectual ideas. Also, don't try to understand it as absolutely empty and quiescent, which maybe is somewhere in Dogen, and the translator thinks maybe this comes from Prajnaparamita Sutras, because that's all about emptiness. That would nicely cover the four most important sutras of the Mahayana: the flower ornament, the lotus, the great Parinirvana, and the Prajnaparamita, perfection of wisdom sutras. That's the source of all these Zen teachings. Don't try to get it from the sutras or from Dogen's words about them. And this is why, he even says, Keizan says, the true marks of all things from the Lotus Sutra still has to do with classifying things, the true characteristic of things. Everything is empty could be seen as the incorrect view of nihilism, so don't try to get it like that. Entire being is Buddha nature sounds like it could be like some sort of spiritual entity or essence of things, so don't try to get it like that. And mind only does not avoid ordinary cognition of things. Of course, he's saying the pitfalls in all these teachings. They're super great teachings, but here we're saying that the Keizan's pointing at the pitfall in any words. Someone who seeks this matter in the 1,000 sutras and 10,000 treatises is regrettably abandoning his father and running off to a distant land, which is a reference to the Lotus Sutra story where the son loses is the son of a great king, but he wanders off and gets lost, and as just a baby, and doesn't remember that his father's the king, and then the father, the king, once sees him in a busy marketplace and tries to bring him back, and he runs away because he thinks he's just going to be arrested. And finally the king designs these skillful means to bring him back. So gives him some like menial work, shoveling manure in the palace stables. And eventually keeps promoting him until eventually he's like the king's main advisor. And then the king's like, actually I'm going to die soon, so all this kingdom is yours. And at that point, this destitute sounds like, okay, I can handle it. So it's a beautiful metaphor, I think, for the gradual path of practice. You can't just go to someone on the street and say, by the way, you are Buddha, completely perfect, and as you are, they'd run away. We say, come sit with us for a while. A long while. And gradually, we're open to our nature, like walking on a day like this, when the mist gradually seeps into our clothing and we're eventually soaked, but we really didn't notice it happening. But if we seek in trying to get it from the sutras like this, it's like abandoning our true father and running off to some distant land. Trying to get the Buddha's awakening through the Buddha's words is kind of abandoning the Buddha, ironically, strangely, from a Zen perspective. when each of you breaks open your own treasure store, or we could translate it as, when each of you breaks open the treasure store of the one true self and carries out the great store of sutras, translator put in parentheses, which is your own mind, the holy teachings will naturally become your own. If you don't understand thus, the Buddhas and ancestors will become your enemies. It is said by one of the ancient Zen ancestors, what wicked demon made you leave home and become a monk? What wicked demon made you wander about seeking Dharma teachings? Whether you can express it or not, you will die from my staff. Some teacher said that. This being so, it is said previously that leaving home is not for the sake of body or mind. Even though Dhirataka understood in this way, he was still not a true patrobe monk. When this was pointed out to him again, he was awakened for the first time and was able to reach the unborn. So there is this thing about this one time that Keizan keeps emphasizing, and the problem about it is if we're talking about an experience that happens at one time, by its very definition, that is something that comes and goes. Any experience comes and goes. Any, especially something that happens at one time. It comes once and it goes once. So then we can mistake this experience for reality, the unborn, unceasing reality. So there's some subtlety here. And I think that happens to many practitioners. We have some experience. The unborn is not an experience, right? All experience is the display of the unborn. So by its very definition, the unborn is not itself an experience. If we're talking about an experience as something that comes and goes, so we might have a dramatic experience that where we really taste the unborn, but actually the experience of that comes along with maybe like an ecstatic feeling or a feeling of total ease and relaxation or something like this. And then we are most into the ecstasy or the relaxation, and we maybe don't even notice at the time it's happening that the reason it's so ecstatic and relaxed is because there's no duality there. But that's quite subtle compared to ecstasy. So then we want to get back to the ecstatic feeling or the relaxed feeling, and which is not really what we want. We might say, yeah, I'll take that. But I think actually my trust is that that's not really what we want. What we really want is the reality that doesn't come and go, of non-duality. And the irony of it is that that reality that doesn't come and go is present right now. It has to be, right? Because or else it would have gone somewhere. It cannot come and go, but we're looking for it in an experience. Because maybe sometimes it's, I was going to say like connected to the experience, but that's not quite right, right? Because nothing is connected to the unborn. I might say maybe we could say that a dramatic experience reveals the true nature of the unborn. But I think often in dramatic experiences, the drama is the very problem, because we don't notice then the unbornness. So my trust is that this awaken to at one time. The Kazon often makes sound very dramatic, like thunder roars and lightning crashes and the whole earth explodes. That's Kazon's style. That's his personality. He likes that. I mean, I like it too, but because we like a good thunderstorm, right? But my trust is that this true awakening can be very, very subtle, gentle, and very undramatic. I think especially for people who've been practicing a long time. Maybe if we've never even heard about this stuff or thought about this stuff, then we get a little taste of the unborn and maybe it seems dramatic. But if we're already sitting in the presence of being over and over again, there's just a little bit of sense of separation or duality there. Then that like little shift into non-duality may be almost unnoticeable, not dramatic at all. And yet I want to give credence to the teaching that it is still a shift of perspective, even if it's a subtle one. Like we might be quite relaxed already, and then shift into this perspective where awareness is pervading the body and the body's made of awareness, and the body relaxes just a little bit more. So there's some noticeable something, or there's a little bit of gnawing discontent. We're basically like at peace here, but this little voice in the back of the mind maybe saying, really? Is this all there is to it? Or like, not quite, something like that. And then maybe this little shift is like, that voice just kind of disappears. It's not an issue. So, I think there's ways to apply the royal seal, and confirm the reality of awareness. But it can only be really confirmed by awareness itself. If good people carefully make an effort in the way, bendo, to practice the way wholeheartedly, we might translate it as, and meticulously practice. So we rarely see this word here, nenmitsu. You may have heard that the style of Soto Zen is menmitsu no kafu. Kafu is the wind of the house. And menmitsu is intimate, careful attention to every detail. So Soto Zen, amongst all these different schools of Zen and Buddhism, the style of the house, the kafu, is menmitsu. This careful attention to detail. So this is one of these places where it gets, Kazon is using it. Good people carefully make this wholehearted effort and practice diligently but meticulously. You might say, paying attention to how we pick up our spoon and so on, and how we hold a teacup, but also carefully and meticulously investigate the subtleties of how awareness seems to meet an object versus how it pervades an object. This is a very meticulous investigation. Do not base understanding on texts, nor discern the spiritual on the basis of ordinary understanding. Smash such distinctions as heaven and earth, ordinary and holy, and personal versus environment, karmic consequences, like self and other, self and the world. If you move back and forth between the past and the future, there will not be a shred of obstruction. Even if you exit and enter above to awakening and below in the service of living beings, there will not be an atom of difference. Paint divisions on empty space and raise waves on the flat earth. Thoroughly see the Buddha's face and thoroughly experience awakening and your bright original mind. Or it could be bright mind, or experience awakening and clarify true mind. Just as a gourd is entwined with its own vines and a bright jewel is surrounded by a halo, one understands the existence of the inner hall of the Buddhas and ancestors, and for the first time realizes it. I'd like to add some humble words to the above story. Would you like to hear them? Keizan says this. He always says that at the end of his exuberant expression. That's maybe he's kind of almost rising out of his seat. And I just want to add some humble words now at the end. By attaining the marrow, you will know the clarity of what you have found. Lun Pien still possesses subtleties he does not pass on, or that he cannot communicate. So attaining the marrow is one of these Zen sayings, going back, I think, to Bodhidharma, where his students express their understanding, and he says, you've attained my skin. This one's deeper. You attain my flesh. You attain my bones. You attain my marrow, he said to Hueka, the second ancestor. So like, knowing on the deepest possible level is like attaining the marrow of the bones. Lun Pien still possesses subtleties he does not pass on. Who's Lun Pien? Where did this guy come from? We didn't hear of him yet. So the ancestor's always making these references. So I'll just finish with this story. Lun Pien, we find, is someone mentioned in Chuang Tzu, the great Taoist manual of truth, Chuang Tzu, Taoist classic, with lots of stories. And this is in the outer chapters of Chuang Tzu and the Way of Heaven chapter. There's this story about Lun Pien. Keizan's verse is, Lun Pien still possesses subtleties he cannot communicate. So here's the story that relates to Keizan's commentary. Duke Wan was reading a book upstairs. We know where that's going, right?
It's so ordinary.
But he's reading a book. And the wheelwright Bien, that's Lun Bien here, this wheelwright was making a wheel in the room below him. We probably don't have wheelwrights anymore, except for like in like the Chevrolet factory and stuff, right? But I think in the old days when they made wooden wheels, it probably had to be very skillful to get a perfectly round wheel with the axle right in the center. A wheelwright is someone who makes wheels. So this Duke Wan is reading a book upstairs, and the wheelwright Lun Pien was making a wheel in the room below him. Laying aside his hammer and chisel, Bien went upstairs and said, I venture to ask you, sir, what words you're reading. The Duke said, the words of the sages. And Bien asked, are those sages alive? And Duke said, actually, they're dead. And Bien said, then what you're reading is only the dregs and sediment of those old sages. You're a dreg slurper. The Duke said, "How should you, a wheelwright, have anything to say about the book I'm reading? If you can explain yourself, very well, but if you cannot, actually you're going to die." That's how I guess they were sometimes in old China. You kind of like rub someone the wrong way and they kill you if they have enough power. But he kind of gives him a chance here. If you can explain why he would dare to say such a thing to me, then very well. The wheelwright said, "I look at this from the point of view of my own art, my own craft of wheel making. In making a wheel, if I proceed gently," one translation says, "if I'm planing the wood gently, then that's pleasant work, but the workmanship is not strong if I do it too gently. If I proceed violently or too roughly, that is toilsome and the joints don't fit together. If the movements of my hand are neither too gentle nor too rough, it accords with my mind. But I cannot tell how to do this by word of mouth. There's a knack in it. There's an art to it," is another translation. But I wanted to actually look up that word knack, because isn't it a super cool word? "There's a knack to it. I cannot teach the knack to my son, nor can my son learn it from me. Thus it is that I'm in my 70th year and still making wheels in my old age. But these ancients and what it was not possible to convey are dead and gone. So then what you are, my Duke, are reading is but their dregs and sediments." Can't really convey a knack. That story, by the way, is not here in Kazan's record to sleuth it out, but Bien the wheelwright. And some things just can't be said, even passing on this skill to his own son.
Did he live?
It doesn't say. But I would think that he did, because it was a nice answer.
He might not have liked it.
Might not have liked it, but it was a pointer.
Maybe
yes.
Maybe he got the knack from the wheelwright.
Maybe he got the knack from the wheelwright. Mm-hmm. And maybe he said, "Well, actually, I've been reading this book for a long time. Let me take a break and I'll go downstairs with you and let's plane some wood together." Been talking a long time here. Let's go downstairs and warm up a Zafu some more. We dedicate the merit of all our conceptual explorations and the merit of our collective knack to all beings everywhere. May they get a knack attack. Smack. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it.